Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of our show, we'll be talking about long-term elder care in the United States. It's been estimated that this year, something like 9 million men and women over the age of 65 will need long-term care. And it's also been estimated that by the year 2020, that number, that 9 million number, will grow to 12 million. And the cost of providing this kind of care is considerable. For example, the average annual cost of skilled nursing care at a nursing home is now at $74,000. It can also be very expensive, perhaps not quite as expensive, but also very expensive for someone to live in an assisted living facility. And there are important questions now that we need to be talking about, because we expect that the number of older Americans will grow, so the number of people needing care will grow, and we expect also the costs to grow. Some big questions here about how it is that we will bear these costs and how it is we'll provide this kind of service. This morning in this program, we'll be talking about long-term elder care in the U.S. with Dr. Robert Kane. He currently holds an endowed chair in long-term care and aging at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center on Aging and also the Minnesota Geriatric Education Center. In addition, he co-directs the university's Clinical Outcomes Research Center. He served as dean of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health from 1985 until 1990, and he has done many research studies, making a special focus the care of older people, especially those needing long-term care. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. That's the idea here. People who have questions, comments, they can be involved in the conversation very easily by picking up the telephone and calling us. If you're listening in Champaign, Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We just ask people who call in to be brief, and we just ask that so we can keep things moving along, get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. Dr. Kane, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm pleased to be here.
Do you think that those numbers, obviously the future, how things are going to play out in the future, anybody's guess, but do you think that those kinds of numbers, maybe 9 million now and within another 15 years or so, we could have as many as 12 million people needing long-term care?
Oh, yeah. But again, I mean, remember that a lot of this is sort of definitional. I mean, what does it mean to need long-term care? And what do we mean when we talk about long-term care? I think one of the things that people keep forgetting is that the vast majority of long-term care is actually provided by family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somewhere in the order of 90% to 95% of all the care that we provide for people who need assistance with things like, you know, the activities of daily living, the things that they require just to basically function, is actually provided by children, spouses, and in some cases, close friends.
Yeah.
And so that is the backbone of long-term care. And when we talk about the cost of long-term care, we need to recognize that if that backbone were ever to become soft, that we would have a much larger problem on our hands than any of our demographic forecasts would suggest.
I think this is a very important point, and I'm glad that you raised it right at this point, because as you say, there are a lot of people that are taking care of a spouse. There are people who are taking care of a parent, and dealing with the out of pocket costs. A lot of the out-of-pocket costs themselves. It may mean that they're taking time away from their children. They're taking time away from their job. It can be difficult. It can be very stressful. And all of that, we really, as you say, when we talk about long-term care, most of the time I think we talk about the issue of nursing homes and are there enough and how much they cost and how do we pay for that. Possibly also talk about things like supports that are available to keep people in their homes, and those are all important things. But I think, as you say, we should not forget that families are doing this now, and we don't figure that into the cost and the effort that's involved in providing various kinds of care to people.
No, and so if we're going to focus our attention, and we may want to talk about both sides, because I think both are very important, and we need pro-family policies to support long-term care. But if we're going to talk about the other side, the formal part of long-term care, the thing that we think about when we start running the cash register, then I think we need to look very carefully at this major paradox that we have in this country, that we are spending a huge amount of money, I mean upwards of $200 billion a year, for a type of care that most people don't want. I mean, it seems to me that's the next big issue that we have to struggle with. Most people would much prefer to be in their home or living in some kind of a home-like environment than to be put into an institution where they lose control of their routines, where they lose control of their identity, where they basically are living an incredibly restricted life. And you know, we call this a nursing home, but in truth, it's not very home-like, and it doesn't actually provide much nursing.
Well, first of all, if you ask this question, there must be people who really do need that level of care. It's custodial care, but they need that level of care because they can't take care of themselves, and maybe they don't have family to take care of them. Is that a need that we are meeting adequately now?
Well, the answer is no. And before we concede that they need that kind of care, we need to define what kind of care they need. They may well need somebody to oversee them because they've lost cognitive function and would tend to get into difficulty on their own. They may need some assistance with various kinds of activities like feeding or bathing or going to the toilet, but that doesn't mean they have to get it in a nursing home. Now, there probably are a small number of people who are really in what we call a total vegetative state, where they are, for all intents and purposes, unconscious and sort of, you know, unfortunately, you know, curled up in a ball. And for those people, the environment probably doesn't matter much. But for the rest, for the people who are responsive to their environments, I mean, where they live and how they live is a vital part of what their life means. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't have to pay the price of giving up all of that living just to get a small modicum of care.
So then it sounds like what you would be arguing for, and I'm sure a lot of other people would be arguing for, is we need to have a range of possibilities. There may be some point when we need to have that kind of care, but that also there are people who are at various levels of independence. They need various levels of help. Maybe there are some people who could continue to stay in their homes. Maybe then we also could think about having something that would be more home-like in the way of assisted living that would be in between people staying in their homes and people in a kind of custodial care situation. It sounds like what we really need to be thinking about is a whole range of kind of
We need both a range, and we need to redefine what we mean by a nursing home. I mean, the nursing home was never created. It simply evolved without much planning. And it was built off a hospital model. And hospital care is not suitable for long-term care. I mean, it is feasible to allow people to live in reasonable comfort, to live in private rooms and not have to share rooms with strangers, and still get the kind of oversight and supervision that we associate with nursing homes. It's possible to get food that actually tastes good. We have medicalized so much of this care that, you know, we now require that the food be prepared under the supervision of a dietitian, but there's no regulation about how it tastes. Now, if you and I were going to make a decision about what we were going to eat, we sure as heck would want something that tasted good. And I, as far as I know, I've never had a meal prepared by a dietitian.
Well, if you ask the question, if you look at the people who are in nursing homes today, is there any way of saying how many of them could have stayed in their own homes for longer if we had the kind of services, whether that would be somebody who would be a visiting nurse or somebody who could visit and help them with various
or much
kinds of
less
things.
Again, these people don't need professional nursing services most of the time. I mean, the answer to your question is that we are already going through a revolution in the last two decades. we have dramatically increased the number of people needing long-term care who are being served in one or another type of community-based service. Some of those are being served in their own home. Some of those, as you mentioned, are being served in assisted living, which is a very imprecise term these days that covers a lot of different ways of living. But they're living in the community, and we are seeing, you know, for the first time, a decline in the number of people in nursing homes. And if you really look at the nursing home population, you discover that a large proportion of it are really very short-stay people who are coming out of hospitals for brief, usually less than a month, periods of recuperation, and then going out into the community. Mm-hmm. So the nursing home, as we know it, is essentially a dying entity. And it's being replaced by more care in the home, by other kinds of living arrangements where people can control their lives much better, and, in fact, by new revolutions in what we actually continue to call nursing homes that are, in fact, making those livable habitats with, you know, what we now call patient-centered care, where patients actually can, you know, sleep in when they want to, can go to bed when they want to, can have meals when they want to. Places that actually allow you to, you know, to live a much fuller life than simply being an automaton in an institution where the patient has to adapt to the institution's schedule rather than the other way around. Mm.
One of the concerns, I think, about the traditional nursing home, just one of the concerns is that to maintain a person there, to keep a person there, is extremely expensive. And we can have people, if they do have some kind of savings in a few years, burning through their life savings, and then eventually we end up with people having to go on Medicaid and having the state have to pick up the tab because their resources are exhausted. If we, you say we're in the process of moving away from that as being the primary thing we rely on, and doing other things, particularly aimed at providing people as much autonomy as they still can have and keep them in their homes. If you take a look at what it is to what it costs to do something like that, how do the costs compare, and does that actually end up to be more cost efficient, or would we, in the long run, do we actually, because we're talking about more people, do we end up spending more money?
Well, the bookkeeping varies a little bit. When we talk about people staying in their own homes, we usually never count in the cost of the room and board that they're paying just by virtue of living at home. Mm-hmm. So that's a slight difference. And that may represent probably somewhere between 25% and 30% of the nursing home cost. But the major cost is personnel. And again, people living at home tend to have, you know, more support from their families, even if they're also getting formal services in as well. And so there's some sort of hidden subsidy to that. But overall, in terms of expenditures for the government, if you look at the Medicaid expenditures, the cost of home and community-based care is dramatically less than the cost for nursing home care. So from a strict government accounting purpose, in terms of, you know, what we spend in the Medicaid program, which is where we track these costs most aggressively, community care is much cheaper than nursing home care. Now, there's also this new phenomenon of assisted living, and there, of course, the cost is proportional to the level of amenities. I mean, you can, you know, basically buy assisted living care in a fairly modest accommodation where you have your own, you know, small apartment like a studio apartment, with your own ability to cook and your own bathroom, et cetera, which is much nicer than what you get in a nursing home. And you can buy that, depending on the place around the country, for probably about half of what you would pay in a nursing home. Now, on the other hand, you can also buy very posh quarters that probably would cost at least as much as what you spend in a nursing home, but you're buying something very different for that money.
Yeah. Let me introduce again just very quickly our guest, Dr. Robert Kane. He is an MD doctor. He currently holds an endowed chair in long-term care and aging at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center on Aging and the Minnesota Geriatric Education Center. And this particular issue, that is care of older persons, especially those needing long-term care, is a special focus of his research and his work. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone to bring into the conversation in Charleston, so why don't we do that? This is our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I'd just like to make a statement, David, concerning my daughter, who is now 50 years old, and she has worked in the so-called nursing home, and which became the nursing home industry since she was 16 years old. And I know of no more dedicated person, not simply because she's my daughter, but because she has had nothing but compliments from the residents and, in the main, people that she works with. I understand that the industry is going to die off, you know, because capitalism is what it is. And the costs of these things that drive the people out that actually need the care. And hopefully some system will be, and I haven't heard the doctor say so yet, what it'll be replaced with. In-home care, and a situation in the family right now where an incorrigible father is now energizing his daughters to madness nearly. And what to do with these folk. But I just wanted to make that statement, David, that this almost brings me to tears when I think of her, but she was 16 years old, and her whole life has been dedicated to that industry. And thank you, and I'll just ring off.
All right. Well, Dr. Kane, can you make
some comments? I think that's a very important statement. I mean, there are a host of unsung heroes, of people who have devoted their lives to providing care for older people. And as the caller sort of hinted at, I mean, it's not always pleasant work. I mean, in many respects, you're dealing with people who are often cognitively impaired. Some of them are both verbally and physically aggressive, and people take a lot of abuse as a result of that. You have to deal with some of the most unpleasant aspects of self-care, in terms of cleaning people up, and people who are often incontinent. These people deserve an enormous amount of credit, and I would not want anything that I've said to be interpreted in any way as deprecating the commitment of these people. I mean, we owe them a huge, huge debt, and in fact, I mean, again, one of the things that I always point out to people is that we survive as a society on exploitation. I mean, we take advantage of their commitment. I mean, these people are never paid what they're worth, and they continue to do this because of a sense of dedication and commitment. Now, that being said, I think there are things we could do to make their lives and the residents' lives better. I don't think that most of the people working in these organizations are necessarily happy implementing a set of very rigid kinds of rules, and again, the rules aren't of their making. Some of the rules are imposed by the situation that we have evolved in this country, which is a highly regulated system of long-term care. We have had various professional groups calling for more professionalization, which tends to make it much more regimented and much more medical, when in fact what we need is something that allows us to provide competent medical care, but at the same time to make it a livable environment. We have not been nearly as creative in thinking about what we want from the long-term care system as we should be. When I teach people about this, I basically try and make the case that there are three major components to good long-term care. We need to have good personal care. We need the people that were just referred to who are providing daily assistance with the kinds of tasks that people can't do for themselves. We need housing that is truly livable. That is, people basically have a right to privacy and to live in enough space that they can really call it a living situation. And third, we need competent medical care. We don't do well on most of those criteria. The medical care that people get in nursing homes really, is not as good as it should be. Physicians don't like to go to nursing homes. We don't have good information systems to help them track patients and intervene early when their conditions are beginning to deteriorate, and so we wait till it's a crisis and then rush them off to emergency rooms and hospitals. We've already said a lot about, you know, the living situation in nursing homes. I mean, there isn't one of us who would want to share a room with a stranger. I mean, I used to go to nursing home conventions, and I would get up when I was giving these talks, and I would just sort of pretend that I was making a public announcement on behalf of the hotel where the meeting was being held, saying that they'd encountered a shortage of rooms and that for tonight only, each of the people in the audience would have to share a room with the person next to them. Mm-hmm. And just watch the, you know, the ripple of panic that spread through the room. And well, yet, you know, we're very happy to say that people like sharing rooms with strangers. Well, they don't.
Well, again, I guess I want to underscore what we have said here. It was not my understanding that the need for this kind of custodial care that the nursing home now provides, we're still going to need. There will still be some people who will need that kind of care. So, but it sounds like, again, what you're saying is that though that we need to think more broadly and maybe more innovatively about what kind of care people need. We're going to have a lot more options. And
I would urge you to cast your mind back to the 1960s. Uh-huh. And say, you know, what was going to be the need for secretaries and clerical support staff? And how fast could they type?
Hmm.
And then think about, you know, the technological revolution that we've gone through in the last 30 years. That basically, I mean, nobody knows how to use a typewriter. And we've, you know, replaced that with a whole new set of technologies that allow us to share information, that make each of us basically much less dependent on other people to produce written information. And I just used that as an example. I mean, you know, you could say the same thing about telephones and how, you know, technology has changed the whole nature of how information is transmitted. Well, if we could use just a fraction of that creativity to say, how are we going to respond to this growing need for personal care and support care that this aging population is going to imply, I mean, we would be thinking in much more creative ways than simply saying, do we need more nursing homes?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that strikes me is that I would think that, again, also we would say, we would not be saying that we need fewer people like the caller's daughter. We're going to actually need more people the caller's
absolutely.
Daughter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Maybe with different kinds of training and different kinds of skills, perhaps, but certainly with the same kind of motivation. We definitely need people like that. Unfortunately, as you also pointed out, right now the people who do that kind of work, they're not terribly well paid. So that's not going to be very attractive for a lot of people the idea for a career.
Right, and it's going to be hard. I mean, if we thought about paying them what they're worth, we would have to put a lot more money into long-term care than we seem prepared to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to have to find other ways to take advantage of these people in a positive way and make their work more satisfying. I mean, think about what happens to somebody who comes in to provide this kind of long-term care. They work very hard. They do the very best they can, and yet over time they see these people sort of getting worse. I mean, that's the nature of the people who are receiving long-term care, and they say, "What I do doesn't make any difference," and they get very frustrated and disappointed. Well, the truth is that what they do makes a huge difference. What they're doing is basically slowing the rate of that decline. But that slowing is invisible because nobody is able to document it and show it to them. And so both they and society as a whole becomes discouraged because they say, well, what difference does good care make because we still see the same end? And the answer is it makes a huge difference. I mean, think about, why are we as a society willing to spend, a lot of money and a lot of effort in things like hospice care? I mean, we know that those people are going to die, but what we've said is that how they die or how they live in the last period of their life is terribly important. Why aren't we saying the same thing about people in long-term care?
Something I want to take up another point, and you touched on this. According to some of the things that I've read, that here in the United States, the number of certified geriatricians, and as physicians who specialize in treating older people, has dropped as has the number of medical students that are interested in that area of practice. Is that an issue? And do you think that there is something that could be done or perhaps should be done to attract more people who are in the study of medicine, know that they want to be physicians, into that area of practice?
Well, your observation is absolutely correct. I mean, the movement to certify geriatricians began in the mid-80s, and there was, of course, a big upsurge because there was nobody, and then suddenly we started certifying these people. And then since about the mid-90s, the number of new candidates coming in to be trained as geriatricians has really dropped off very dramatically. And I think that's due to several factors. One is there's been a general decline among physicians in terms of their enthusiasm for going into what we call primary care, that is things like general practice, internal medicine, even pediatrics. Physicians are now attracted to more dazzling technologies that pay better, get more respect, and are sort of more fun to do. And the old-fashioned doctoring is much less appealing to them. And then it's a subset of those people who then would carve off to become geriatricians. So there's a real trickle-down phenomenon in which the stream has really dried up, and so there are fewer people going into it. To make it worse, geriatrics doesn't pay very well. I mean, the way Medicare reimburses care is on a very fixed basis that basically favors high technology and short visits. Geriatrics requires long visits and low technology. We try and save older people from unnecessary technology. Mm. And so the whole payment system runs counter to the basic principles of geriatrics. And so you have a problem of generally fewer people interested in primary care as a whole, a poor payment system, and then an awful lot of people find dealing with older people very difficult. The older people don't communicate as quickly as younger people. They have multiple problems, and so it's hard to sort out one problem from another. It really requires more time and more patience than many physicians are willing to give. And so as a result, it has never been a terribly popular option, but it's becoming even less popular over the last decade.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580, and for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'd like to introduce again the guest we're speaking with, Dr. Robert Cain. He is an MD. He currently holds an endowed chair in long-term care and aging at the University of Minnesota. He directs the Center on Aging and the Minnesota Geriatric Education Center, and in his research and in his writing, he's done a lot of work dealing with the subject we're talking about here this morning, care of older people, geriatrics, long-term care. And that's what we're talking about here. That is the issue of long-term elder care in the United States. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me get into another area here.
Let me pick up one other theme first. Finish your question.
Yeah.
The question is, where is this medical care going to come from if the doctors basically desert it? Mm. And I think the answer is going to be nurse practitioners.
Huh.
We are seeing now a dramatic increase in the number of nurses being prepared at the master's and now doctoral level as nurse practitioners, and we have good data to suggest that they can carry out many of the tasks that primary care physicians have routinely provided at the same level of quality, and they seem to have a better temperament for doing geriatrics. And so I'm betting on geriatric nurse practitioners filling a big part of that void that you've been describing.
Yeah. Well, I think that probably for some time now, as we have asked this question, how do we meet the need for medical care, and particularly how do we get at this for people who are in some kind of managed care situation? I think probably one of the leading complaints they have is that they don't get to spend very much time with their doctor. And I think for a variety of reasons, we have said, well, if we could get more people in there and particularly have someone who would be more available, who, because of the way the position is structured, could actually spend some time with the patient, that actually would be good for everybody. It would be good for the institution. It would be good for the patient. A lot of people said, well, yeah, the nurse practitioner is the natural person to take on that responsibility. I think, though, in the past, there's been maybe a little bit of friction between the nurses and the doctors, and there with some issues about, okay, who's in charge, and doctors not wanting to, some doctors maybe being a little hesitant to give up their position. Do you think we're getting to the point where that kind of argument, we just don't seem to be having that kind of argument anymore?
I think it certainly has been dispelled in most places, and I think except for some insecure physicians who are threatened by these, you know, nurse practitioners, you rarely see that raised anymore. And in fact, increasingly, the nurse practitioners are performing on a level of parity with the physicians. I think we're also seeing a change in the way we think about how medical care is delivered. As we move into a world that is dominated now by chronic illness, which is indeed the reality, we come to appreciate that our approach to how we give care has to change. I mean, we can't simply, you know, pay for or focus on the here and now. We need to recognize that more and more care is sort of an investment in the future, and that if we give more competent primary care early in the course of a disease, we actually head off those expensive emergency room visits and hospitalizations that are, you know, neither pleasant nor cheap. And so, I mean, it's a whole different sort of preventive focus to, you know, what good care means. And it means more active involvement of the patients in taking care of themselves, because nobody can be around 24 hours a day. It means developing early warning systems that identify when a patient's course is beginning to change so that we can intervene early rather than waiting for the crisis to hit. And those kinds of things can be very well managed by nurse practitioners.
We now have several callers here. We want to bring them into the conversation, and we'll do that just in the order they came in, starting with someone on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
In Newsweek, I read an article about a new type of nursing home where it was really much more like a residential home, and the residents each had private rooms, and they, you know, cooked meals together, and it just sounded, you know, much more homey and enjoyable. And I was just wondering if you think, is that a model that is going to be successful financially and catch on? Is that something that we can look for to be more common in the community and more available? I'll just take your answer off the air.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, you're describing a program called the Greenhouse, which the pilot project was actually developed in Tupelo, Mississippi. And indeed, it does represent a different way of organizing care. And I think it is a very important step along the way to showing that we can deliver nursing home care in much more commodious, livable kinds of environments. And that program is being replicated. There's a large foundation that is putting a substantial amount of money into trying to develop replications of that program across the country.
So, but that just, it seems that instead of having a relatively small number of very large institutions that might have, who knows, hundreds of people there, it's one of the things that we're thinking about or looking at, having more smaller settings, things that would be almost like group homes, and maybe that's not the right kind of word to describe it, but a much smaller scale kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's a general consensus that the large institution come institution is a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And what people are doing now, and again, part of this involves, you know, a large construction cost, and so, you know, people who've invested in one kind of building are sort of loath to, you know, make major changes. But we're finding, again, creative architecture that's taking these big buildings and literally breaking them up into smaller communities of 10 to 12 people and developing, you know, common dining areas, developing common living areas, in some cases reconfiguring the rooms so there may be smaller single rooms than these double and triple rooms that we've had, so that people have an opportunity both to interact with other people in the area, but also to retreat when they want privacy into a place that they can, you know, call their own.
Yeah. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This would be line number two.
Yeah, just a comment. I go to a general practitioner here, but he had, you know, I've dealt with the nurse practitioners, and I, quite frankly, am impressed. Just very, very pleased. So I think it's certainly definitely a good solution. So that's my only comment.
All right. Well, there one patient says he thinks that that's just fine. How can you say anything about what generally reaction of people is to the idea?
I think the reaction has been very positive. I think that, you know, that people generally, you know, see the nurse practitioners as often better communicators. They may or may not, in truth, spend more time, but at least you feel like you've been heard better. And I think part of it is probably related to gender. I think that, you know, that women are just generally better communicators than men.
Well, let's talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wanting to know about dementia. It seems that's a growing problem and will become more of a problem this century. And I was wanting to know what kind of forecast do you see in terms of how many people might be suffering from it, and what kind of provisions are being made to care for people with that condition?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Kane.
Yeah, I mean, your caller's absolutely right. I mean, dementia is probably one of the most serious and frightening problems that we associate with old age. There's still a debate as to whether, you know, virtually everybody will become demented at some point if they live long enough, but certainly the rate of the onset of dementia goes up dramatically with age. I mean, up to, you know, better than, you know, 35% if you get, you know, above age 85. Again, dementia has a course. There's mild dementia and severe, and dementia has a number of different kinds of etiologies. The forecast for the need for long-term care will vary dramatically depending on your optimism as to whether we will find an effective treatment for dementia. At the moment, the drugs that we have are not really very effective. People are optimistic, or at least in some quarters, that indeed, you know, new breakthroughs are going to, you know, come, but we've heard those predictions before, and a number of us are sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude. Caring for dementia is enormously taxing. It takes a great deal of patience. The people with dementia, particularly as they get more severe, tend to become more difficult to manage. They often may become confused. If they're not managed skillfully, they may become abusive, either verbally or physically. They certainly are prone to wander. They are very repetitive and taxing and asking the same questions because they don't remember what they just talked about. And so it is going to take a very special workforce to do that. We have experimented in this country with trying to develop dementia-specific units where people with dementia are sort of clustered together. The data so far doesn't show any better results for the people with dementia from those kinds of units. There may be some improvement in the lives of the other people just by having taken those people out of their environment, but there's no strong evidence that kind of isolation has proven terribly effective.
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. Did you have any estimates as to how many people might be suffering from dementia in the next 10 to 30 years? I've seen estimates of between 10 and 20 million, and I was wondering if that's about correct or what
your
thoughts were.
I mean, I haven't done the math, but I would guess that's probably not too far off. I mean, remember that we have not only more people that are aging, but they're aging to longer ages. They're living longer. And as a result, the likelihood of contracting dementia, I mean, just goes up logarithmically once you pass age 75. So the more people we have in their 80s and 90s, the greater the risk that they will develop some kind of cognitive impairment.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. I guess, you know, one of the things that I wonder is that if we concentrated more on the idea of wellness. And I think probably most people know what's good for them, whether they do it or not, that's something else. But, I mean, if we get more people to follow what would be most physicians' short list of things to do in your life to live a longer, healthier life, whether we would indeed have our older population would be healthier Then the other situation as well, you know, would be have a whole lot of people whose bodies were relatively sound but whose minds weren't. Or maybe we still would have various kinds of chronic illness to deal with. What do you think about that whole argument that says if we could get people to live a healthier life, then once they got to be older, they wouldn't have as many problems and care wouldn't be as big of an issue?
Well, we are seeing, in fact, a reduction in sort of age-specific rates of disability. It's only a couple of percentage points, but it's real.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, we are already doing that. Again, the major contributors to that are probably the reduction in smoking. But there are sort of two kinds of wellness behaviors that one can pursue. One are behaviors that affect the onset of diseases that have serious health consequences. And the irony there, of course, is that if you are successful in postponing the onset of those diseases, you're also successful in postponing dying from those diseases. And so you have people who are, you know, living longer to contract other kinds of problems that may make them disabled. So you can get a sort of paradoxical effect there. The second set of diseases are diseases that don't kill you. And there are some preventive strategies there that certainly work, and there are some great success stories. I think, you know, one of the big success stories of the last couple of decades is what we've done with osteoporosis. There, it's not so much practicing wellness as it is taking a medication. But if you think about where we've made great strides beyond stopping smoking, which is certainly important, our great strides have largely been in the pharmaceutical side. We've developed drugs that can lower cholesterol and have been related to the reduction in heart disease. And we've developed drugs that basically have reduced the rate of hip fractures from osteoporosis. So both of those, I think, are major accomplishments. They're not formal wellness as we think of. The terrible story that we have, of course, is what we've done with regard to our diet. And there, of course, we counter most of the other benefits, and indeed are seeing a rapid increase in the rate of diabetes, which is basically a disease that ages you more rapidly than you would otherwise age. And then the other area where we've not been very successful is physical activity, which seems to confer a generally positive benefit that's as much nonspecific as specific.
We have just about 5 minutes left here. Let's continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Watsika. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions. My parents, when they got into their 90s, we ended up taking care of them. And my dad had a stroke that, along with dementia, but he had no physical impairment, which made him very difficult to deal with. And both he and my mom spent the last few months of their life in nursing homes and were very unhappy about it. But we just couldn't find any other means of coping with those problems. We had a nursing home here we thought was quite good. I had an interesting thing happen, though. My mom was apparently complaining, and we were out of her room, and an aide going off duty came to us and said, keep track of thus and so, because, you know, of something she heard going on. But it was very difficult to do anything about it. It was a particular individual who didn't cope well with cranky old people. And I was kind of interested in what could be done without, getting something accomplished, but still not causing the problem to get worse. The second thing is, we've been looking for ourselves some assisted living facilities and finding them near our daughters, which is the Chicago area, to be very expensive up there. And do you have any thoughts on how to look at the range of things available, how to contact them or how to find them?
Yeah, first, relating to the issue of your father, I can sympathize with that. I mean, one of the epiphanies in my life was actually when my mother had a stroke. And I discovered that, you know, somebody who had spent his life researching this area still had a hard time getting good care. In fact, I would commend to you a book I wrote called It Shouldn't Be This Way, which basically describes my sister's and my frustration with trying to organize care for my mother through a series of assisted living facilities and then finally a nursing home. I think, you know, the problem that you describe of, you know, I mean, how hard do you push back on the staff and complain about, you know, potential problems is a very difficult one. I mean, you have to learn to be a very skillful negotiator and know when you want to press your case and when you want to hold back, because basically you're in a very weak bargaining position with the institution. Essentially, they can simply say, well, you know, we just can't take care of your father, and you have to move him out, which doesn't give you very much leeway to maneuver. Or you have this terrible fear that somehow some kind of retribution will be taken out on him because you were a complainer. On the other hand, I certainly observe that the squeaky wheels do get the grease, and you have to be an effective advocate on behalf of your parents when they're in those kinds of institutions, because people do respect the fact that they're being watched, and they do respond to that.
Yes, but you can only be there a limited time.
But that's true. But when you're there, you need to, you know, just basically advocate on behalf of your parent.
Yes, but there was somebody there daily.
I know the problem, and I know the fear. If you think it truly is a life-threatening or personal-threatening problem, then you have to obviously, you know, call them out on that. If not, you have to try and find ways to sort of cope with that. And as I say, choosing your battles is a very, very tricky choice.
Yes.
The question about assisted living, I mean, the answer is that there are national directories that you can go to. There are national organizations that list their members that allow you to look it up. But there is no good information system that gives you, you know, the equivalent of the, you know, a real estate multiple listing service where you can actually find easily on site the characteristics of different places and make comparisons, nor is there any good information about the quality of the care provided in those places. And so basically it does come down to shoe leather and going and looking at them, unfortunately.
Yes. One third question. We're AARP members, and we're reading now about the contracts you sign on some of these organizations give them the right to decide when you no longer can be there. But in addition, at least in one case in California, they owned a nursing home, same organization, and moved a lady out whose personal physician said she didn't need to go into one of their nursing homes. And she had already signed a contract when she went in years before.
Yeah, you're raising a very good point, and certainly a caution that everybody should be aware of, and that is you need to know exactly what you're signing up for and what are the conditions for discharge, what happens to the change in payments as your condition changes. I mean, all of those need to be laid out very, very explicitly. But even after you've done that, you're going to need, you know, good advocacy, which may be yourself, and it may be that you're going to need legal help.
To actually
be prepared to press this case. I mean, in most cases, most of these statements that these organizations make don't have any real grounds to fall back on, but they just intimidate people into basically, you know, doing what they want. Or you have an organization that says, we can no longer provide safe care for you or your loved one. And so what are you going to do? You're going to come back and say, well, I'm going to make you do it even though you're incompetent? You just don't have, you know, a bargaining point there. So it is tricky, and again, I mean, that's why we try and you know look for, you know, reputation and track record, and go to the places that have done a good job in the past, because they're more likely to do it in the future. But there's no systematic rating system that you can use to look that up.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate the information. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate the call. We have a couple of other people, and I'm sorry to say that I don't think we're going to be able to take them because we're really right at the end of the time. I'm sure that in future, with other guests on other shows, we will be getting back to some of these same issues. Any last sort of thoughts you'd like to leave with folks, Dr. Kane?
No, I would just put in a plug for this book because I think it does provide some useful information for people. It's called It Shouldn't Be This Way. And it's written by me and my sister, Joan West, and it's available from Amazon.com. And we wrote it because, I mean, I was just so frustrated that, you know, I mean, my argument was that if somebody like me couldn't make the system work, what chance does the average person have?
Right. Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Dr. Robert Kane. He holds an endowed chair in long-term care and aging at University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center on Aging and the Minnesota Geriatric Education Center. And in his work has written a lot about care of older people, geriatrics, long-term care issues.